Hi, it's Tim Dre, president of the Illinois AFL-CIO. Thank you for listening to The Worker's Mic, supported by the Illinois AFL-CIO, fighting every day for working families. Visit ilafl-cio.org today. Enjoy the show, and remember, it's better in a union.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Worker's Mic right here on 720 WGN, powered by the National Coalition of Labor, Ken, Ed. And we're super stoked to have in the studio today with us Dave Amerson. He is the what's your title now?
I'm the executive director of the Illinois Police Benevolent Labor Committee, the police union.
The PBPA.
Yep.
The Illinois. Say it again.
The Illinois Police Benevolent and Protective Association Labor Committee.
Okay.
Yeah. And well, that's a long name.
That is a long name. And so, and it's a police union.
Correct.
Okay. And you are. You're an attorney, correct?
I am an attorney.
Where'd you go to law school?
The University of Illinois, Champaign.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
It's no John Marshall.
That's for sure, those, obviously.
It's one of those downstate three-bit okay. outfits.
Is it online? That's an online school?
No, they don't have. We don't have electricity yet.
So, and you were just promoted to this position, right?
Yes.
You were like general counsel for a while?
No, I was a staff attorney.
Staff attorney.
I focused mostly on organizing, but
gotcha.
We have 110 units across the state.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That many?
Yeah.
Where, like, how far is, like, what's your jurisdiction geographically?
Well, I'm probably the most widespread because, I have this kind of, whenever we organize a new unit, mm-hmm. I seem to be the one that takes them through their first contract and
sure.
then some,
right? Yeah.
And then hand them off to other staff.
Uh-huh.
But we have, me personally, I have East St. Louis, Springfield, Bloomington Command, small counties. We have a lot of civilian units, too. We have white-collar municipal and county employees. We have a lot of dispatchers and a lot of correctional officers.
Gotcha.
Yep.
What about in City of Chicago?
City of Chicago, we represent the sergeants, lieutenants, and captains, all who have their own bargaining units, so three separate unions.
That's right. And one of them, Mike Stezak, mm-hmm. does our taxes for the coalition.
Yeah.
Just recently retired.
Yeah, they're definitely Renaissance men and women for sure.
Well, there's no question about that. So how many? Okay, say again. You got in Chicago. You got the sergeants,
correct?
Lieutenants,
yes,
and
captains.
And so what's top captain?
Captain's top. And what's interesting about Chicago captains and even lieutenants is you're a Chicago captain probably has more subordinates, more people under his command than any chief anywhere else in the state.
Really?
Right. Like, I mean, look at a place like Rockford, Springfield, Peoria. They might have 260, 300 police officers.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago captain, I mean, you're talking thousands.
Sure.
Right. So, yeah, it's interesting because they're also unionized, right?
Right.
Despite having that much authority.
Mm-hmm. How long have they been unioned?
Oh, that's a good question.
Since, like right around the start of the Labor Act, like 1984?
If that's probably when they were actually certified.
Got it.
I think that there was always a bargaining relationship there. But correct, you know, I should know more about my own union's history in that regard.
You've got a hard enough job.
Yeah.
Don't beat yourself up.
That
on
was
this
a
one,
trick
please.
Question. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And with the gotchas.
All right, so let's talk about broad brush for a quick second. The PBPA is an independent union.
Correct.
Right? Yes. So you guys are not part of the AFL-CIO.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
We work closely with a lot of AFL units,
sure.
obviously, and
yeah.
we're in solidarity with every union, but yeah, we're not.
Are you part of the state AFL-CIO?
No, we have a close relationship, but we are not officially an affiliate of the Illinois AFL-CIO. We are a part of a national group called NAPO.
Yes.
What
does that stand for? National Association of Police Organizations or something like that?
You got it. That's exactly
is that what it is?
Good okay. guess.
I didn't like that.
Man.
But, yeah. And
hey-o.
Lottery ticket.
Hold on a second. Thank you. Got that right.
I think it's probably similar to AFL in the way that the AFL actually operates. I think a lot of people have this understanding of the AFL-CIO and these kind of umbrella organizations mm-hmm. have like direct control over their affiliates, when really it's more of
yeah.
the other way around, right? That they're constituent organizations,
yep.
and that's how it is for
so,
us at that level.
So yeah, you guys, right, then you have the Metropolitan Alliance of Police, mm-hmm. MAP, right? And they're also members of the coalition, the NCL.
Mm-hmm.
You have ICOPS, recently joined the coalition. And then you have the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police.
Correct, yeah.
The statewide, and then Lodge 7, which is the Chicago cops.
And that, well, there's a statewide for state troopers.
Got it.
And then there's also the one that represents municipal and county
police. Got it,
police, right? So they have four or five different organizations.
So, Dave, let me ask you this. Unlike the firefighters, right, the mm-hmm. IAFF,
yep.
right, mm-hmm. They basically represent, if you're a firefighter, chances are 9 out of 10, you're in that union. Right, there's a couple of, I think, Teamsters and maybe some SEIU and a little bit here or there, but for the most part, it's kind of like one-stop shopping. Why are the police so divided here in the state of Illinois with like four or five different units? And I think there are even some Teamster police, maybe some AFSCME police as well, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, why this amalgamation?
I don't know the genesis of why that occurred. I can guess. You know, we, for instance, started, I think, about 90 years ago, purely as a benevolent organization, police benevolent, right? So the idea being that if you get killed in the line of duty, we're going to pool money and we're going to help support your family.
Yeah.
Right. And then that kind of eventually evolved into collective bargaining.
Got it.
Right. So there were different kind of organizations like that. But you touch on a very good point. It's unique in our world that there's so much competition in our labor market, right? Whereas most unions, they don't typically, and in fact, they consider it distasteful to, quote unquote, raid each other, seek out other membership. With us, it's constant, right? Like, we're constantly being raided. We're constantly having to, it is a touchy subject in the labor movement. But I will tell you this, at least we can't rest on our laurels, right? We can never let standards slip. Any mistake, I mean, it's almost zero tolerance, right? Especially in the world of policing where, you lose a grievance if you're a truck driver.
They're jumping ship if you're...
Right. If they perceive that you're not going to be there for them 24 hours a day, seven days a week, and get the job done right, then they are going to go somewhere else. So it does... We have to maintain a very high standard.
Keeps you on your toes.
For sure.
How many members are in the PBPA?
So the bargaining unit members, I think we're probably close to 5,500. Okay. But if you count our association members, those people that maybe aren't in a bargaining unit, retirees, and then also as you get promoted out, right, you can still be a member of the association.
Yeah,
over 10,000.
Wow, that's pretty
good. We're also in coalition with MAP, the Metropolitan Alliance of Police. So between the two of us, that's probably like the largest coalition of municipal and county police.
When you say coalition, what does that mean?
That means that we work together. We actually do have we're not going to compete with you, agreement.
Oh,
we're not going to raid each other.
Got it.
That we're going to work in concert because our values and our philosophy of police unionism align pretty well. Yes.
So if you're not fighting each other, you can actually, move the ball forward.
For sure. Definitely.
It must be, so the AFL-CIO, for those listening, they have a rule against what's called raiding.
Correct.
Basically, it means that an AFL union can't go after another AFL union's group. They call it raiding, right?
Yeah.
And there are some exceptions to it, et cetera, et cetera. But because the police are not part of the AFL-CIO, they can raid each other.
Correct.
Right? And just like the teachers, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. One is AFL. The other one's not here in the state of Illinois. They're equally, like, what, 100,000 each?
Mm-hmm.
I believe
IEA and IFT do have an agreement not to do
good,
it to each other.
Good, that's good. I know they didn't back in the day.
And again, generally it's good. I wish we could get to a point where that was the case.
Yeah.
Right, but, I have to take the market as it's given to me.
Let me ask you this, Dave. Speaking of market, right, the market share for unionized police officers in the state of Illinois is what? It's got to be in the 90s.
Oh, much more. I mean, if you're counting people that could actually organize, not your supervisors and things like that, actually unionize. I mean, I'd be surprised if it wasn't 98, 99. And the only reason that some places aren't is because it's just too small.
It's
hard to dedicate staff resources. And I have a hard time saying no.
Yeah.
Right? When someone says, I want to unionize.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of small units. I just finished the Springfield Park District contract. That's three guys. Right? I'm the executive director of the union, right? It's like, so, just.
You know what? But everybody deserves a union.
That's right.
We used to have this argument at 150, and I shouldn't say argument because I was told what to do. And we had a minimum in my world, which was public works, and it was 10, right? And I complained about it, and I went to the boss, and I was like, what happens if there's nine guys? Are we going to say no? He's like, I was like, we shouldn't have a limit. He's like, what's your limit now? I'm like, what you told me, 10. He's like, well, now it's 20.
And maybe the juice isn't worth the squeeze a lot of times, but if you're in a market where you already have a lot of units, like say Sangamon County where I'm at with Springfield and so on, if you do have several small units and they're taking crappy wages, it depresses everything else.
All day, every day.
And if folks are passionate and they want a union, they should get one.
Right, and just big, small, whatever, you're a basically certified Illinois police officer, and that comes with a lot of legal liability. It comes with potential criminal liability if you get the job done wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So everyone desires representation. It's really hard for me to say to someone no.
What's this whole, anti-cop, mentality in the city, state, it just seems like, you know, look, I've heard unions, by the way, I'm going to say this out loud. I've heard unions tell their members that police don't belong in unions.
Mm-hmm. I have heard that.
And yeah. I just think, like, that is the most horrific thing a union can say. I can't get over the fact, like, it's okay for us, but cops shouldn't be in a union. Right?
Right.
It's just crazy to me.
And it comes from a place where you're viewing unionism as a privilege and not a basic right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and also coming from a place where you view unions perhaps as a way to unfairly protect people and not raise the bar. Right. But when you look at, say, the trades and labor, that labor that you're getting out of those people is much higher because they have better wages, because there's a higher competition. And so I think, you know, I mean, I think it's good for citizens to have a healthy skepticism of their government, of policing in general, and that's fine.
You've hit the nail on the head lately.
Healthy.
Right.
We'll talk about that.
And I guess my general view of it is I can't go around and change the minds of, you know,
of course
8
not.
Million people
yeah.
mm-hmm. about this topic. But what we can do and what good unionism is about is raising that standard, raising the bar. And I think that good unionism is a way to bridge the gap with the community to show them that, hey, let's start with us. We are a part of the community.
Right.
We are workers.
Right.
We're treated fairly.
Yep.
We expect other workers to be treated fairly. We're not an occupying force. We're not something above and beyond or different.
Yeah.
We are part of it, right? And we're a vital part of it. And I think that good unionism is focused on that. And sometimes, though, it's so easy when you're pressed in these circumstances to, instead of winning the contract fight, instead of actually bringing gains to your members, to gauge in demagoguery, to, you know, get on Facebook. And I tell my members all the time, like, you know, if you want to win a Facebook fight, join a Facebook group.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to win a contract fight, yeah. Right, here's the game plan. Here's how we get it done. And that's the most important thing for us at the end of the day, is actually moving the ball forward.
Of course.
In real ways for our members, because it really plays into what management does all over the place. They try to pay you in pride. Right. Well, you should want to do this. You know, you're mission driven. This is, you know,
well,
teachers hear this, nurses
yeah.
hear this.
Yeah,
you know,
right, yeah.
public employees all over the place.
Union lawyers.
Right. Yeah. You should be happy to be here and all yeah. this type of thing. Or they puff you up in some other ways. I mean, I tell workers all the time, once they start calling you heroes, you know, like hold on to your wallet.
Yeah,
right. Because
like
they're trying to get out of actually treating you like a professional.
I like that. I like that a lot. Like, yeah, we're the heroes during COVID are now, you know, with the Uber drivers and the delivery drivers and whatnot. Now sure. they're getting replaced by Waymo and
right.
robo taxis, right? Those are going to be the next heroes during the next pandemic. But yeah, I agree with you. So let's pivot for a second. National Guard, right? Troops getting sent in. You know, what are the Chirac or whatever he said?
Yeah,
you know, that our
cesspool.
You know, our crime is terrible, terrible, terrible. What is, from a police union standpoint, what does it look like when, you know, big government, which we're supposed to have small government, says we're going to send in the National Guard to the city of Chicago? What does that do to the cops, to the police officers that actually have to stay and work here day after day after day after day, year after year, when National Guard is at some point going to leave, right?
Right.
So what do you guys think about that?
Right. So I think typically being embroiled in these kind of national controversies
mm-hmm.
Can drive a wedge between the community and the police. You know,
yeah.
Thinking about specifically, and again, this is getting back to most police officers every day, they're not concerning themselves with these kind of political ideas, right? That doesn't fill their world. What fills their world is responding to calls,
yeah.
being safe, protecting their fellows,
right?
Right, protecting the community,
yep.
right? Actually getting the mission done. So just looking at it from a nuts and bolts perspective, I think the big question is, well, what would be the mission of the National Guard? Let's engage for a second. Assume it's not political theater.
Okay.
What's the actual mission of the National Guard coming here? Well, when the DNC was here, they did force protection. That's what we call, you guard certain sites.
Mm-hmm.
That frees up your actual rank and file professionals
mm-hmm.
on the Chicago Police Department to do actual police work.
Got it.
Right. But what it isn't and what it couldn't be is responding to crime, right? Or to actually responding to, say, calls for service. When someone calls, they're not going to get a 19-year-old National Guardsman who last week was selling shoes at the mall,
right?
And who just got caught up. This is not a professional. This is not a person that's capable of actually doing that type of work. You know, I was in the Marines.
You were?
Yeah, I was in the Marines for 5 years.
I didn't know that.
And
you don't look like it.
I'm kidding.
It was a lifetime ago, right?
Good for
people
you.
Say, you know, once a Marine, always a Marine. I think I test that proposition a lot.
That's funny.
But no, you know, if you're in the military, you can certainly guard a piece of property and prevent people from getting there. If there's a riot, you can prevent people from advancing down a street.
Sure.
But we can't solve a murder, right? We can't resolve a domestic violence dispute, right? We can't do these types of things. It takes really skilled professionals to do that kind of work. So, you know, if it's what the nation, the way they're framing it, and then that kind of national conversation is, well, we need to send the National Guard there too because there's a crime problem. Well, I don't know how troops can fix a crime problem. Certainly, if you put a troop on every single corner of Chicago, maybe you're going to see a downtick in crime.
Right.
But how long can that even possibly last? What are the ramifications of that? If you're going to spend all this money and all this time and resources, right? If, again, if they just came here and did these kind of force protection things, maybe it would help. But if it is about political theater or something else, or just a national conversation type of thing, I would rather see that amount of money coming from the federal government going to actually hiring and recruitment retention for current police officers, for hiring more supervisors.
Yeah.
So supervisors don't have such a wide span of people that they have to supervise.
Right.
And to actual real policing by actual real professionals. Like,
so you're saying basically take the money that you're spending, federal government, and you want to put your money where your mouth is, help us hire more police officers. Right?
Sure.
Help us, you know, do the day-to-day stuff. Don't, you know, just send in the troops or spend a bunch of money, you know, for like you said, political theater. That doesn't really get us anywhere. So you can upset the community.
Sure. But that being said, I do think that there's probably, among our membership, there's a lot of people that would welcome some sort of assistance from the federal government, right? I think, my opinion, just working on the ground, is that is a outgrowth of staffing problems that we're having. Certainly in Illinois, but across the country as well, in police departments, it's extremely difficult to have people do this kind of job, right? Who wants to be the subject of this kind of legal liability, to this much public scorn, and do such a difficult job to get to do it, right? So
nobody, right? I mean, like, isn't there a dearth of applicants now?
It's extremely difficult to find people right now. And, I mean, and that's the other thing, too, is if police are beginning to welcome it. And I think just as a general union principle, if I have X amount of man hours, I want my union members, my trained professional union members doing that work.
Of course.
I don't want someone else coming in and doing
it. Good point.
Right. So if you're a union member and you're already thinking to yourself, well, I would welcome this, I think that's an outgrowth of the fact that you are deeply overworked.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I have some agencies where you get into your car, you already have 7 calls in your queue. And it's going all day, every day, call to call to call to call, sometimes for 12-hour shifts, no bathroom breaks. I mean, it's just constant work like that. So they feel it, and if they're not actually seeing good recruitment and retention coming up. So if you're a police chief, you're in this really difficult position, right? People are going to keep calling no matter what's happening with the national conversation, no matter what politicians are doing. People are calling constantly because they need the police there.
Sure.
Right? So if you're a chief, you need bodies. You need people that you can actually send to these places. So you are in a position where if no one is applying for this type of work, what is the natural thing that happens? You're lowering standards. They hate to say it. You'll never get the chiefs to admit it, but they're lowering standards. You can go ask any rank and file cop anywhere in the state. Mm-hmm. Do you think standards for new hires have gone up or down in the last 5 years? I will guarantee you every single one of them will say it's gone down. What's interesting about that, this is at a time when if I could distill the national conversation about policing and certainly the conversation in this state about policing into one sentence of what do the citizens want from police? They want higher standards. They want more professionalized policing. Mm-hmm. They want more training. They just want more from police officers. And right now, no one, they're not getting it, right? And the problem is that no one wants to do this job. And, you know, it might sound self-serving for a union to say this. I really think that the only true way to do it is to attract them, like any labor market anywhere in the world, is you have to raise the price point.
Of course.
You have to actually compensate people to do this kind of job.
Absolutely.
And that's the one thing that chiefs, that cities don't want to do. It's very much similar to what you see in the private sector ever since COVID, right? Is if you go to a restaurant right now and you're complaining that it took 45 minutes for your plate to come out, you never see a waiter, I guarantee you that they're underpaying their staff there. That's why.
Sure.
They can't attract people to the job.
Absolutely.
Right. We've been hit over the head with this kind of like labor market kind of economics our whole lives, my entire career.
Yep.
Now the shoe's on the other foot, and they do not want to admit the fact that they're just not paying people enough to do that kind of job. So instead, it's, we want to be a fun place to work or a good place to work and have people, here's your pizza party, and we want you to be valued. Or you know, that's their carrot approach, or the stick is, you know, we're going to take measures to make it so there's a much higher level of unemployment, so people are more desperate for jobs,
right?
Lowering bargaining power for right. everyone. But if you're in policing, you know, you can't really play around with standards, especially as they're raising and raising and raising. So we're really creating a situation where, at a time where there's so much scrutiny on policing, we are pushing people that probably 10 years ago would not be police officers into policing. I hear this time and time again, especially downstate. I'll ask someone and say, Springfield or Bloomington, when you tested in, say, 2005, how many other people tested? Oh, 300 people tested to be a police officer. How many did they hire? Five. Okay, your last testing class, how many showed up to test? 10.
Wow.
How many did you hire? Five.
Wow.
Right. So they used to get the cream of the crop,
yeah.
the A team.
Yep.
Now it's literally anyone that can basically pass these minimum standards.
So if you were to, you know, say to somebody that's thinking about getting into law enforcement, you know, like what would you advise somebody? Like, my son was a criminal justice major in Philly, and, you know, he's kind of pivoted and said, I don't know that I want to do this for a living, especially given the fact that Philadelphia, much like parts of Chicago, is really, really rough. And when he sort of got that and sort of eyes open, he's like, hey, how much does that pay? Like, and I'm going to do that. He's like, I don't know that that's right for me.
Well, and that's a really good point, right? Policing has really transitioned into a more professionalized kind of job. Whereas 20 years ago, it was viewed as a very working class job. Now it is seen as a profession, right? And so, which means that if you want people that can do this job, you have to, you know, you want to go after that person. It's like, maybe I want to be a teacher. Maybe I want to be a social worker. I always want to be a police officer. What's going to get them to pull the trigger on that? It's going to be...
Pull the trigger? Hey-o.
It's going to be pay, generally. Right. And if it's something else, that's not something I can control at a bargaining mm-hmm. table. That's not something a politician can control, right? I mean, people say all the time, well, the media is really rough on policing, or state, you know, all this. I can't change that, right? I can't go around and change the media narrative about policing, right? That is the bargaining environment that my members are in, right? And so if we want to retain good cops, if we want to recruit good people, because, you know, I try to put it this way, and policing has gotten so difficult where I think there's been a lot of focus on cases of excessive force, but more sure. and more what I'm seeing is a lot more cases where officers are afraid to engage when they have to, right? I'm seeing a lot more discipline cases where what we call failure to investigate, right? Where officers should be more aggressive, should wade in there more, but they're scared, right? Either because maybe they shouldn't have been a police officer in the first place, some cases.
Okay.
But a lot of cases you're deeply afraid of the legal ramifications. If you get it wrong,
yeah.
you could go to jail
yep.
if you get it wrong, or you're certainly going to be subject to intense public embarrassment, scorn. You're going to be in the newspapers
sure.
if you get it wrong.
Yep.
So most people are saying, I'm not going to wade into that, right? So thinking about policing nowadays, we want from police officers to be extremely tactically proficient, right? Like, think of Uvalde, for instance. That's the thing that everyone always talks about. You do not want that, right? You want a police officer that's courageous, that's tactically proficient, that's going to run in there and is trained and capable to do that. And when I was in the Marines, they taught us that 40% of Marines do not fire their weapon the first time they're in combat.
Right.
Because it is jarring.
Yeah.
You know, it's a psychological hurdle that yeah. people have to get over.
That makes sense.
And so you just come out of the police academy and you have to run in there and do that.
Right.
Right. So that's the higher end
yeah.
of aggression.
Yep.
But every other moment of the day, we need you to be judicious on the street. We need you to be able to de-escalate, to talk citizens down, to calm situations down, and to handle it in a professional manner, applying a myriad of laws, rules, policies, and regulations to do so. You're talking about a high caliber individual that can operate effectively in between these two bands. And my concern is that the way that local governments, politicians have approached this issue, they do not want to actually talk about what it takes to recruit those kind of people. You know, they'll say, well, we're very proud of you and we really support the police. Like, okay, well, here's how you actually support them. Here's
right.
how you make it safe. Here's how you engender community trust in us.
Yeah.
Right. Is attracting these type of people to the profession, retaining the good people that we have right now, and you're not doing that.
Oh, listen, I'm tired of hearing people talk out of both sides of their mouths. You know, we support the police, you know, and blah, blah, and they don't do anything for them,
mm-hmm.
right? Or pass laws that make it more difficult to be a police officer, right? Or take funding away from municipalities, you know, for police officers and training and things like that. I mean, look at the building trades, right? It takes, what would we have, the apprentice on from IBW down in
197.
197, yeah. Jason, right? 5 years to be a journeyman.
Right.
Right? It's 5 years of training, right? So he's not like, okay, you're at academy, voila, you're in the police car. Go make that quick, you know, 2 second decision that might, you know, get you killed or get somebody else killed.
Sure.
Right? There isn't any of that.
Right. No, it's I hear that a lot too, from people. Well, you know, it takes longer to get through barber school than it does to become a police officer. And I said, the police officers aren't in favor of that kind of
right.
program.
Yeah.
Right. We would much prefer this to become a longer training program. We want higher standards. We want the field training that police officers receive to be intense. We want them to be closely scrutinized by senior officers. But more and more, we just get pressure all along the recruitment pipeline. Push them through, push them through, push them through.
Right.
Right. And, you know,
that's how I got through law school.
and you know, at the end of the day, I think we have tried to raise the standards for policing, certainly in the state of Illinois, by increasing legal liability, right? And some good things too, you know, increasing the amount of training and those types of things. But we're not doing what comes with that when you increase standards in that way or expectations in that way. Mm-hmm. Actually, make sure you're recruiting and retaining people. So in reality, you're actually raising the standards on the ground of the type of people that you're attracting to the profession and retaining those good people that have experience.
You make a lot of sense. I have a question for you. Do you know how many officers in the city of Chicago, I'm just talking city now, that they're down?
I do not. I mean, it's got to be in the
thousands.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that the tests, like you said, Ken, that used to be full, they're having a lot of trouble filling the rooms for these tests.
Right. In Chicago, is extremely difficult place to be a police officer. It's very complex. And I will say, you know, and this is probably, certainly I hear the community talking about this issue a lot. Chicago is one of the only cities left in Illinois that has a residency requirement, where if you're a police officer, you have to live there.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And without getting into whether the merits of residency, I generally think it's not, it doesn't do what people assume it's going to do.
Yeah, it's a hurdle.
Right.
It's an antiquated requirement. Most municipalities have gotten rid of residency requirements.
Sure. It does come from a place where, well, we want people policing that are from here. Well, you're not, first off, not everyone that becomes a CPD officer grew up in Chicago.
Right.
Right. They don't have that kind of cultural attachment.
Sure.
Right. You're forcing them to move here. Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, you're paying a high premium to attract people. We've been talking about that all along. Right. Right. Like if you want residency, fine, but you have to pay for it. Right. And more and more, like you said, it's become very antiquated and it's making it difficult for Chicago to recruit officers because, you know, no one wants to make the argument that, well, we want people from here. I think Rahm Emanuel said, well, these are our softball coaches. These are pillars of our community. I'm like, I don't think most people, if you force them to live in a community, do that. They become the pillars of the community. Right. Yeah.
But if they've already lived here, right? Yeah, sure, maybe. But
it also comes from this notion. I mean, I hear it downstate a lot. Like in Springfield, for instance, people say, well, we want residency here because we don't want some kid from a farm patrolling, you know, like our streets and our urban areas. And yeah, it is, from me and my perspective, and I think this ties back into unionism, is, you know, there's an assumption that someone must be inherently racist or unable to do the job if they come from an area outside your city,
right.
If they come from a rural environment. That's right. Not been my experience at all. I do think that perhaps if you grow up in an area that's predominantly white, there is maybe growing pains, right? But when I was in the Marines, for instance, I mean, you have people from rural areas, you have people from New York City. They come together in a common purpose,
sure.
Working together, right. Striving for the same goal, you become friends and close, mm-hmm. Very, very fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, you cohere.
Yeah.
Right? So I think it's also that part of it, and it's just a political hurdle for some, but I will say Chicago is certainly paying the price for it in recruitment and retention.
Well, look at what, you know, just when we first started the show, Brandon Johnson, our mayor, right? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Whatever his name is. said, you know, they asked him point blank, like, are you going to put resources and hire more cops? And he literally said, no, we're going to get to the root of the crime, and that's how we're going to solve it. And, you know, here we are 3 years later.
Yeah.
That hasn't worked.
Well, and it's, I hear that a lot.
And why not do both?
I hear that a lot, and it's, no city, I think, has the resources to fix generational poverty. Let me just put it that way.
Of course not. It's a massive undertaking. Word salad.
Right.
It literally word salad. It means nothing. They didn't, you know, what are you going to do? Hire 200,000 social workers to fix the ills
of society?
I think
that's what they were talking about was bringing in this massive wave of social workers that does not exist.
No, it doesn't exist. You know why? Social workers get paid 20 grand a year.
They're the folks who make less than the cops and also have just as hard a job.
We work in a lot of agencies that say, they use behavioral health specialists. They'll ride with one cop car at a time or something like that. So sometimes it can be useful, but there's not enough, obviously, to replace.
And
the amount of mental health issues that you deal with as a police officer, like you said, the workforce just isn't there for it.
Yeah. Listen, and you guys, you know, have a high rate of suicide, right?
Yes. Substance abuse, suicide.
Yep. Yeah, all of that. Like lawyers, I think. But it's high stress, right?
It's high stress. Yeah, you don't feel anymore, especially a lot of edification from the community for the type
of
job
you do. And you're seeing the worst of the worst of humanity when you're out there on the streets.
Right, and it naturally impacts your home and family life.
Of course.
Right? So there's a higher rate of divorce.
Now we're talking, you know, here, I'll say this as well. I find it interesting because when we were at 150, Ed, right, in the public sector, I would negotiate the public works contracts, and I would always look at fire and cops, and they would always tell us, you know, well, they're the heroes, and, you know, you guys are not, you know, and we would, of course, say, well, they couldn't get to where they need to go unless we plowed the streets, you know, whatever. We had the argument of who's best, but I was watching some of the salaries, right, like really skyrocket in some of these wealthy municipalities, and then you come to Chicago, and I would joke, like, hey, in Wilmette, you know, I think there's a rash of teenage smoking. We got to stop that, you know. And these guys are making more money than a Chicago cop.
For sure. If
you're a Chicago cop, or if you're a police officer, or you're thinking about doing it, it's like, do I want to work in Wilmette, or do I want to, you know, work on the south side of Chicago?
I think it's a trend that you see with police officers as well as teachers in a lot of cases is when you're starting out, you go there to put in a couple of years,
learn.
And then when you're able to come out to the suburbs, like there's a little bit of a shift out to the suburbs.
You know, and typically how you would see that is like, say, smaller agencies. We call it like launching pad agencies.
Okay.
Right, where you go somewhere where it has like four or five people, you get some experience under your belt, and then you build a career.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe your goal is being at a municipality, maybe it's being a state trooper, maybe it's being a federal law enforcement official in some way. But now you do see a reverse of that, right? Where the city of Chicago people are, well, I was here for 10 years, so I could go to Aurora, where right now, just finished an Aurora contract where the sergeants in Aurora are going to be making their top out is going to be around $190,000 at the end of their career.
Whoa.
Right? And that's what you have to do to retain
In Aurora.
Right.
And that money goes a lot further in Aurora than it would here.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Or imagine Springfield. Springfield's one of the lowest cost of living cities in the state, right? And so it more and more, the complexities of being a Chicago police officer, it's really hard to find people that want to wade into this atmosphere.
Sure.
Right? With this much intense scrutiny on your job.
Yep.
And do it for relatively lower pay than what we're seeing around the state. It's not keeping up with the market.
What does a Chicago cop start at here?
I'm not, you know, I don't have the rank and file, so I'm not sure off the top of my head.
I don't think it's very much. I thought it was, for some reason, I thought it was much higher than it actually was. And when I actually looked at it, it wasn't, you know. And what about this? What about places like Florida putting up billboards?
Sure.
Hey, Chicago police, come to Florida. We'll give you $5,000 or whatever it is.
Is that working? I don't think that's probably not pulling a lot of people from actual agencies. In my experience, I haven't had anyone really biting on moving out of state to work as a police officer in those types of places because that amount of money, I mean, we routinely bargain higher signing bonuses for police officers than what they were offering. I thought it was
I don't know that I'd be wanting to go to Florida anyway.
Let me ask you a question. In the city of Chicago especially, I feel like police have a difficult enough job with what they have to do. They also face a lot of pressures from the public and, you know, like, let's just be honest here, a lot of sort of negative feelings from the public sometimes that are driven by factors that you mentioned, you know, policymakers, the news, whatever. It seems like that started to get a little bit better over the past couple of years, maybe. The sentiment on some of these federal troops, like ICE agents specifically, where people don't identify themselves, people wear masks, they just grab people, throw them in cars, don't say anything, and leave. It's gotten a really negative reaction from the public. how does that trickle down to local law enforcement folks? Are they seeing hostility in general toward law enforcement because of that?
I haven't had anyone articulate that to me yet, yeah. that they are feeling more. I mean, I think it stands to reason, right? To the extent that you're associated with any kind of police practices that are seen as overwrought or brutal or authoritarian in some way, that that's going to have some effect on your relationship. But also, I do think that probably most Chicagoans can recognize the difference between a masked ICE agent and a, you know, a Chicago police officer, right? So it is really about, like, the image and the quality and standard of service that the Chicago police officers provide that I think it's an opportunity for us to set ourselves apart.
I agree with you.
Like when we show up, you know, we are handling this in a judicious manner. We don't have an allegiance to a politician. We have an allegiance to the Constitution of the state of Illinois, to the federal Constitution and the laws and the policies. And ultimately at the end of the day, the citizens of Chicago. Okay.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think that every
it really is. I'm
confident
that it's actually refreshing to hear.
I think every member that I have, look, police officers, like every union member, like every worker out there, they have a host of things that they're thinking about that I guess form how they vote and, you know, their politics and things like that. I don't look over their shoulder when they're in the voting booth or anything like that. Hell, me, like every other union, we just tell them, David Amerson, the executive director, I'm a single issue voter, and it's union issues, specifically my union's issues.
Sure.
That's what I care about, and that's what I'm going to communicate to you. When you go in there, though, you're going to have a host of things to think about. But at the end of the day, these are professionals, and when they show up to work, they are not going to handle a call any differently because they're a Democrat, because they're a Republican, right. because of how they think about these types of things. They're going to do it based on their level of professionalism, their level of skill. And that's really where we see our union's role in the situation is raising that level of skill. I mean, I tell my people all the time, if you're a bricklayer and you have an apprentice and you can't make a straight line, you don't want him in your union. Right. That person brings down your bargaining power.
Sure.
That you might be great at something else, right. but not as a bricklayer.
And that's something that we actually have control over, that we can actually say, hey, this person isn't cutting the mustard. Pushing back on this kind of tendency from municipalities and politicians to just push bodies into there, that we can be the people that are saying this person isn't up for the job, right? Yeah. At that level, right? I mean, once you become a fully trained union member, we're here to protect your due process rights and all those types of things. But at that level, we do have a role in saying we want to maintain the standards of our profession and how the public views us.
Is there a probationary period?
Every police agency I know of has a probationary period.
Yeah, makes sense.
What is it, usually a year?
A year to 18 months after you get out of the academy. So, I mean, there's a host of ways that people handle this. Springfield, you know, I'll talk up Springfield a lot because I think it is one of the preeminent law enforcement agencies that they do a very good job.
I take it they're your members.
They are my members, and I'm from there. But no, objectively, I have been very impressed with that police department, at least in recent years. They had a chief a few years back that I think wasn't too great for him, but they've really climbed out from under it. But the good thing that Springfield does, you go to academy as a police officer. Downstate, there's one in Decatur. Mm-hmm. It's very well-funded. I think like Warren Buffett's brother funded it or something like that. Super there's a whole other story about that. It's a very nice, well-funded facility. Police officers go there. They come out, and then in Springfield, you go to their own academy, right? So you get even more training, then you enter your field training phase.
Got it.
Right, for a year. Now 18 months.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we've increased it to 18 months.
Yep.
Where that's your on-the-job training, where you're constantly monitored, making sure you can do the job before we're going to release you out there, right? But that part's not required. Agencies could cut that and say, as soon as you come into the academy, you have a badge, you have a gun, you have 3 months of training, get out there, fella.
Yeah.
Right?
Good luck.
Right.
Yeah.
And so
hit the streets.
Right. And that, I don't think that's a good model.
Agreed.
For policing, both as a citizen. And again, I'm not a police officer. Okay. I don't play one on TV. I don't pretend. I'm a civilian just like everyone else. But working in this field and observing them and just dealing with these issues day to day, it comes very stark and obvious what the actual problems are. And it really does come down to staffing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Because if you're well-staffed, if a lot of people want to be police officers, you can pick the very best to be police officers, and you can retain the very best. But now we're in a situation where we made a big splash politically, raising the standards for liability, right? The difficulty of what's going to happen if you do a bad job.
Yeah.
We stop focusing on how are we training up people to do a good job.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, I remember, you know, when Chicago was going through terrible riots and things like that, the building trades, you know, were the first to come out and say, no, we support our police. Didn't Sweeney like make up all those signs, the yard signs?
Yeah, it was, if you oppose the police, don't call them.
Yeah, sure. Right. But I mean, the building trades traditionally are pro-police, right?
I'll say, you know.
It's a hard job. Yeah. To realize that.
And again, that goes back to, I think that, let me put it this way, and, you know, I think that most working class people, right, across this city, across the state, they do not have the same kind of level of, I guess, antagonism towards police on like a philosophical level,
right,
as say a college educated kid that lives in the suburb.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I do think that's a divide. And, you know, you mentioned before, yes, I have had some union people say, I don't think police unions should exist. I don't think police should be in unions. I've never heard that from an actual union leader. I haven't heard that from virtually any union member. Okay, working class people, I think, do appreciate that the necessity of having a police force, a well-trained police force.
Yeah.
But then they see now today with body cams, which, you know, actually I think have been wildly helpful for us as a police union.
Well, you only see the bad ones on TikTok.
Well, yeah,
that's a good point,
right? Nobody's showing like, hey, you know, officer so and so just solved this crime.
That's a good idea for a TikTok page. Good body cams.
Hey, officer, thank you so much.
It'd be intensely boring. That being said,
it'd be boring. It'd be great. Maybe not. It might be boring.
Hold on a second. That's a really good idea. So
police PR folks, so if you're listening,
yeah. So TikTok, you know, like somebody come up with a body body
like helping people out
cam, body positive cam, or something like that, right?
Make it like that judge from Rhode Island that used to just let everybody off their speeding tickets because they didn't have any money.
Yeah.
Well, and it, just the nature of social media, what you're actually going to sit there and spend time looking at before you swipe,
right?
It's going to have to be a body cam. These are, you know, to grab someone's attention. The police officer is either doing something wrong or the citizen is making a fool of themselves, right? Like the show cops.
What do they call it? Doom scrolling.
Right.
Right? Like, you're not scrolling for, like, happy things, you know?
And that's not 99% of their day, right, those types of things. But it does create oppression in people that aren't in neighborhoods where they feel that oftentimes they do need the police or they do at least see a value in it. But I think everyone can agree they do want higher standards from policing. And I think that's what we've been talking about is we want higher standards for policing, too.
Right.
I just think that we're the only ones that are truly honest about how you get there.
Have we ever had somebody from the police union on? Alex came on from
ICOPS, yes.
Right? I think you're literally the second one to come on.
Sure. Well, and
everybody's like, oh, I don't know if I want to come on. You know, it's
such an important thing to do. I mean, people have to realize all the things that go into your job because public trust is so hard to build and so hard to maintain.
Sure.
And I think a lot of it rests on folks remembering that you have a really hard job, and it's to help people. Yeah. Bottom line, you're here to help people.
Right.
And you know, this is the most controversial thing I'll say among police unions.
Oh, boy.
What you just said, I think that applies to certainly every public employee that I've ever worked with, and probably most private sector employees, too, actual employees, actual workers. You know, you'll never catch me denigrating a teacher's union or a state and county municipal employees union, or a bricklayers union, or any union out there, right? We're a complete solidarity because at the end of the day, our jobs are extremely similar. Teachers went through this very similar to what police are going through now 20 years ago.
Sure.
Right? There's all these problems, socioeconomic reasons that there's bad test scores, just like there's all these socioeconomic reasons there's crime in an area that dictates the police response to it. And instead of focusing on those, you know, the thing that the mayor of Chicago, you know, says that he wants to focus on,
right?
Instead of focusing on those things, or we say, well, this person that we actually see, the face of it, the teacher, right? Or the face of, on our end, the police officer, that's who we're going to go after. So let's do No Child Left Behind. Let's focus on she must be the problem or he must be the problem, that teacher, for this entire web of issues.
Right.
Right. And now it's happening to police officers as well. And that's why I often encourage members, like, hey, other public employees, like, not everyone can do your kind of job, but all these jobs are important. They're essential to the community. And we, you know, if their struggle is our struggle.
There's no question about it. I agree with you. I don't have that same view about certain unions, because I think, in my humble opinion, some unions are aggressive and strong and good, and some unions are resting on their laurels,
for sure,
right? And not moving the ball forward. You know, like what happens when a union doesn't do a good job, right? So you're talking about the union as an institution. The people that are the union members, doesn't matter what job they're doing, every single, like you said, every single job has dignity. Doesn't matter if you're a janitor, you know. Ed, we were talking about Disney, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? I rolled in here this morning, and there's a Roberto downstairs, the garage attendant, and I was like, hey, where were you last week? He's like, I took my family to Disney. Well, Roberto's a proud Teamster 727 member. He could afford to do that, right? He's like, good for you. It's like, so.
Well, I think that's a good point, too, that the level of aggression. When I came into this line of work, when I started my career in the labor movement, it was 2010. Right, 2011. And that was Madison, right? I happened to be in law school. I was taking labor law classes. Mm-hmm. Madison happened. I had Professor Matt Finken, who's widely known in these circles. And I said, hey, I want to go to Madison and participate. And he said, go for it, right? And so it really, that's what started it, which means that I have never known the good times, right? As some, may, you know, people that have more years of service in the labor movement remember, right? Maybe before the financial collapse in 2008, or if there ever was a good time. Some unions, certainly the trades, certainly the industrial unions, it's probably felt like there hasn't been a good time in decades, right? But
yeah, we're doing okay.
But,
right?
So,
I mean, it depends.
The past
I mean,
6 months haven't been peachy, but leading up to that, it was A-okay.
And then my first job was Pat Quinn was the governor of Illinois, and he was attacking the union that I was with. Then we had Bruce Rauner and so on, you know. So I'll say my entire career I felt like it's been a fight, and not only been a fight, but I've seen the necessity of taking risk, of being aggressive and leaning into the union aspect of it, because it's just so easy sometimes, I think, for union attorneys certainly, and some union leadership, to say, well, we would like to kind of stay out of it, we just need to keep steady the course. And I think in most places you're not meeting the moment right now. I mean, this is very interesting times we're living in right now.
You couldn't have said it better, Dave. I agree with you 110%. When a union attorney says, yeah, we shouldn't take that case because we don't want to set bad precedent, or when the AFL-CIO, you know, years ago, I don't know, like, I wanted to do X, and they've like literally like blacklisted me. They're like, don't listen to Ken Edwards. Whatever he's telling you to do, do the opposite, because we don't want to set bad law and blah, 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 blah. And like, look, you got to take risks. We got to move the ball forward. We got to do what we got to do. You have to meet the moment. And if we're not being aggressive, right? Aggressive. I'm not talking about playing defense. I'm talking about playing offense. The best defense is offense. And we have to do that. And too often, I think labor doesn't do it. We do it in the trades, right? There's no question about it. We push the ball forward. But like you said, when a lawyer tells you, like, I don't think you could do that, that's the easy way out.
Sure. Like,
figure out a way for me to do it then.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Don't tell me why I can't. Tell me how I can.
Don't tell me to stay out of trouble. Get me out of trouble.
Yeah. That's exactly
I need a
right.
wartime conciliary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I like
And so, you know who really put it well? Bill, my first job in the labor movement was AFGE. That's the Federal Government Employee Union.
I'm familiar.
And
it used to exist 6 months ago.
Right. I was a legal intern there, and I had the opportunity to meet Bill Fletcher Jr., and he wrote a lot of good books on unionism. But he really put it really well, this kind of moment and the need for aggression. And he's like, you know, I like military history. If you've ever seen Band of Brothers, there's this scene where the lieutenant is trying to kind of coax a private into fighting. And he says, you know, the problem is you think that you have a chance of surviving this. Right, you need to operate as if you're dead already. Right, and from the labor movement, like, we've been under constant attack.
Yes,
right, for 40 years certainly.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could say since our founding, you know, since the Taft-Hartley Act and before, even we've been under attack. And so,
sometimes literally with guns.
Sure, 100%.
Right,
in the up till Harlan County, USA, documentary, right, 1973. This is in the 1930s.
Yeah.
They're shooting at people. They're throwing dynamite at striking
That's
mine
right.
workers. Right, so it's been a constant fight, and you know, I think the only way forward is to assert yourself as a union in whatever terrain that is, and saying, you know, we're going to push the ball forward. We're not comfortable with what we have.
Yes.
Now, in my world, there's no other option. Right, police unions have to be advancing our message of staffing, contract gains, and so on.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's the only way forward. I'm not going to sit out here and point at 8 million Chicagoans and say, you should have a different opinion about the policing. I mean, I think that's what politicians do. They blame their electorate.
Sure.
Right? what we can move the ball forward on is the standards of policing and how we get there.
Yeah.
Right. And that's through contract gains. That's through making sure that standards don't fall to meet staffing, you know,
right.
bad staffing problems and so on.
Dave Amerson for President of the United States AFL-CIO. All right. I hereby nominate you.
Sure.
Because you're saying the right things. You're saying everything that I want to hear from labor leaders. Listen, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the ride up here. Means a lot to us because you came from Springfield, right?
Correct.
If people want more information about your organization, the PBPA, who would they call? Where would they go?
They call me. You know, you can call our office, but you go to www.pbpa.org.
Uh-huh.
We have low dues, and I plow as every cent that we have into staff repping and organization. So our website does look a little... you know, old-fashioned. It's not like GeoCities old-fashioned or anything like that.
Yeah.
But give us a call, you know, and we'll talk to anyone. Hell, if you or if you're in a union that you don't want to switch to PBPA or you don't want to be unionized, I'll have a conversation with any worker about their rights. And
good.
You know, I don't.
Good for you. Good for you. Appreciate it. Appreciate everything you do for labor.
Dave.
Thank you so much. We're going to be right back with more of the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.